Radio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and we are talking to Mr. Steve Jaffe from Los Angeles. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how you doing, Len?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me tonight. I wanted to ask your opinion on what is the latest in JFK research, because you've been working on a few things, and every now and then I hear there's a documentary or a book or something you're working on. But I think I would just start with by saying you must have heard that there is quite a few files. Is it 80,000 pages?
80,000 pages. So yeah. For the most enthusiastic investigator, that is daunting. And fortunately, there are enough people who have read a lot of the other material, and we're talking about hundreds of books, looking at, a lot of footage from documentary footage. I mean, you know, we're going back over a decade, over a half a century by a considerable margin. And there are a lot of people who are slowly, like myself, reading these 80,000 pages that were kept classified all this time. Evidently, they had said the reason for the classification was that it would not jeopardize anybody's safety in terms of national security. So I guess the gloves are off and the danger is gone. But unfortunately, that doesn't hold true for a few people whose entire identities and social security numbers have also been redacted along with the stuff they meant to keep secret. But it is a great time, you know, to after all these years, that there was declassification. And this time, finally, Donald Trump, after promising before, has been the one to release these documents. And they are now in the hands of a subcommittee under the tutelage and chairmanship by a woman who's a congresswoman named Luna.
And she seems to be interested.
She seems very forthcoming. I found her to be not only aware of the task, but she sounded capable of the task. And she knows that having committee hearings is something which will expose her to the public. So from a politician standpoint, you could accuse her of doing it for reasons of career, but I don't find that to be true after hearing the first hearing and or watching the first hearing. And I think that she's a responsible person and has an appreciation for what she's doing, as well as for the kinds of people who are still alive. Some of them are experts. There are very, very few, if any, witnesses still alive who would be called at trial about the assassination or for the alleged assassin of the president. So I think she's got a very good start. I watched the hearing with Jim DiEugenio as one of the witnesses, and Jefferson Morley, who I'm proud to call a friend and who I respect greatly for the work on JFK Facts, online. And I think that everybody's kind of got a new breath of air.
Well, certainly having Oliver Stone there, too, it gave it a little bit of oomph. Like, people were tuning in, and they were saying, like, you know, Oliver did the film in 92, and then he did 30 years later, Destiny Betrayed, you know, the four-hour documentary of, you know, we know so much more after 30 years. And now he's saying, look, you really should have released these a long time ago, but
right.
now is the time to do it, and don't hold back. And,
right.
You know, I got the impression that she was very interested, you know.
Yeah, her first press conference, she said something, you know, they were clamoring for answers related to the evidence, but she had just been handed 80,000 pages of documents from the CIA files and from the FBI files, some of which they just discovered before she started her task. And she said, I can tell you that from what I've just seen, there were two shooters. Now, I may be butchering that a little bit in terms of quoting, but she didn't mention two shooters. And getting that from the evidence after, you know, just having acquired it is a pretty bold statement when you consider that the government had been sitting on the Warren Commission report for 70 years, and she...
Yeah, the poverty of that, you know, keeping
yeah,
it hidden. Yeah,
that's incredible.
And the other side of the coin is, all these revelations do not point to Lee Oswald. It's not like, oh, we told you he did it, here's how he did it, you know? No, he
yeah,
had nothing.
No, yeah, you're right, yeah. It's incredible. I thought that Oliver Stone has always been humble and has never tried to paint himself out as an expert, even though obviously he is. His contribution is immeasurable. What he did with the film, the role of Mr. X, who was, as you know, played by Donald Sutherland and was literally playing Fletcher Prouty, and Colonel Prouty's contribution to this case will not be known for maybe hundreds of years, but what's been out so far has been very quickly bringing things into focus. I also think that, you know, it was great that Oliver Stone was there for the first hearing, because his film, when JFK was released, caused the Congress to vote 100-0 to establish a law about releasing these documents. And so he got to see the fulfillment of his artistic work in history. And I thought that was a great moment and a great draw.
It's such a tragedy. I wish it was something more positive you could cheer about. But, you know, it's like they murdered John Kennedy, and they covered it up. And the fact that they were able to get Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission, and then that's, like everyone has said, like the, you know, the Fox investigating who raided the hen house, right?
Yes, exactly. It was like, I think it was always in my feeling that it should have been called the Dulles Commission, because he really ran the commission, and Earl Warren had never wanted the job, but was forced into it, like some other members of the commission, by the president, Lyndon Johnson. And Dulles, who we can now see played a part in the masterminding of the assassination plot, he had control over the aftermath and what we all call the cover-up. And so by exerting his control, and Hoover exerting his control through the FBI and his directorship since its inception, and Dulles almost since its inception in 1947, he was the director of the CIA. So I think that, you know, those pieces now make things come into focus, and we're not being, you know, swatted away by people demanding us to believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. It was an impossible task without the power of the people who covered it up. You know, the actual shooting was a homicide, but it was done by professionals. It certainly wasn't done by a poor shot in the Marine Corps. But, you know, the cover-up is important. The cover-up is the key.
Also, when you take a look at Commission Exhibit 399, you go, you're gonna tell us that that happened? Regardless,
yeah.
If you want to blame Lee Oswald, and he's shot and killed, still in police custody.
Yeah.
Now, people who may not be familiar with your work, you were working with Jim Garrison, friends with him, and you were able to go from French intelligence to get one of the first copies of the Zapruder film for Jim Garrison.
Yeah.
And that in itself is monumental.
I met Mark Lane in 1966, just a few months after Rush to Judgment, his book, his best-selling book on the Kennedy assassination, was published. And it was selling out all over the world, not just in this country. And so he introduced me to Jim Garrison, who was the district attorney of New Orleans, and who realized that while Lee Harvey Oswald had been labeled the assassin and was dead, that Oswald had lived in New Orleans, which was in Jim Garrison's jurisdiction at the time of the assassination, and then also in 1967 when he began his investigation, which is why he began his investigation, because he felt that there was a good chance the plot, and the evidence indicated, the plot had also been participated in during the period leading up to the assassination in the parish of Orleans, which was the DA's, that was his jurisdiction in New Orleans.
But still, I just have an admiration for somebody, you know, that went and did some of this digging and for you to get that film.
Oh, yeah, let me jump from that. Once I started working for Garrison, his first question to me, basically, when I was introduced to him by Mark, was, I volunteered. And he said, well, do you have any skills? You'd think his first question would have been, do you have any experience? I did tell him that I'd read the 26 volumes and that I was up to speed on the evidence that existed as far as we knew in public. And he said, do you have any skills? And I said, well, I've been a professional photographer during the time that I was attending the University of California. And while I was at UCLA, I did photography for the newspapers. I did photography in all arenas, even sports. And but it was also the anti-war movement, so I was photographing a lot of the events that took place then. That's how I ran into Mark Lane. I went to hear him lecture after reading his book. Then Garrison hired me. He said, I have an office full of photographic evidence and film evidence. And he said, I need a specialist who can be our forensic investigator. And that brought me to the most important piece of evidence in the whole case, as far as I was concerned, which was the Zapruder film. And if for those of you out there who haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. You can just Google it. And the Zapruder film is a film of the assassination. So it's pretty strong stuff to show a jury. But when Jim Garrison, as district attorney, sent a subpoena outside of the jurisdiction area of the state of Louisiana, he found that the federal government wasn't cooperating with him, that Hoover wouldn't cooperate with him or anybody. And even in the private sector, Time Life magazines, Time Life Publishing, they had bought the Zapruder film literally within 48 hours of the assassination. And so it was shipped off, and Zapruder had I think, three copies made, one of which was given to the FBI, one of which was after, this is after it was processed, and he kept a copy. But the original was sent to a number of places, and when we subpoenaed it, what showed up in a very a professional-looking case that unlocked and had in it a small spool of film, when we pulled it, we were wearing gloves and to keep from harming the film. But when we pulled the film off the spool, it was clear. You could barely see any emulsion or, you know, any paint on the film. And you couldn't see what happened at all. So that became a problem for us in terms of getting evidence. Garrison sent me up to look at the film in the National Archives, and that was clear. And you could see what happened, and boy, I've never and will never see a piece of film like that in my life. It was so shocking, and it was so clear that he had been shot and killed by somebody from the front of where his limousine was on Elm Street. But we couldn't get a copy, and so I was acting in another capacity as a liaison with French intelligence, because I posed to Garrison, I said, look, if our intelligence agency is resisting every effort you make to get information, as well as the FBI, but not so much, and not as much as the CIA, why don't you let me contact, since I was in Los Angeles, I wasn't in the New Orleans office, can I contact some of the other intelligence agencies and see if they'll give us any of their information? We got a very warm invitation from General de Gaulle, president of France, and his the head of his intelligence agency, which is known as the SDECE, the Secret Service, for all intents and purposes, invited me and said to Garrison, send somebody, one of your people, to Paris next week. And, you know, we talked about it in code as if it was a book publishing that they were interested in. We knew what we were talking about. I went to Paris in June of 1968. And I met with them over a period of days. Sadly, during that time, Bobby Kennedy was shot and killed and assassinated in Los Angeles during the campaign. But they gave me a copy of the Zapruder film, and there's a whole story to that, but they gave us a near-perfect copy because it was very close to the original, and they had given it to Perry Matsch. Perry Matsch was a sister publication in a joint venture with Life magazine. So they were publishing the same quality pictures in their magazine as Life was in their magazine from that film of the assassination. And I got the copy. It was given to me in a way so that it couldn't be stolen from me on my way home because they expected me to be intercepted. And we got a lot of other information from them because they had sent us a manuscript or what I told you, you know, they were talking about publishing a book. And what they did was they sent us a manuscript of three volumes and bound in black, you know, just mimeographed. And Garrison read them on his way out to the coast in L.A. to meet with me and Bill Turner, who was also working for us. He was a writer and a former FBI agent, and he wrote for Ramparts. In any event, we got a really high-quality copy of the film, and I made copies for anybody who wanted them. I sent them to a lot of investigators so that they could have them for themselves and copy them. We wanted to disseminate it as much as possible, even though we knew there was a violation of copyright. But if there was, it was just something that we would have to deal with when the time came.
Well, that made it to the various lectures that Mark Lane had given, and once people saw that, then they really realized it. I think it sank in that the government was lying.
Yeah, I mean, the government's position was that someone shot President Kennedy and killed him from behind in a building called the Texas School Book Depository on the sixth floor of that building. As Kennedy drove by in the limousine and the motorcade, but he died from a bullet that was fired at him from the front. And you can't be shot from the front and the back. I mean, you can by two different shooters, but in this case, the fatal shot came from the front, and all the witnesses, at least 50% of the witnesses in Dealey Plaza pretty much held the same view for one reason or another. I wasn't too involved in the ballistics part of it. I was trying to focus just on the forensic evidence from film and photographs.
So now that they're starting to release documents, and some of them are still a bit redacted, there's still more to come. I think just this week they're releasing photographic evidence of Bobby Kennedy being shot. And some people were saying, oh, how can they do this? I mean, these are murders. These are murder crime scenes. If you're interested and you're looking at it, of course you should release it. And the fact that someone could be innocent in the case of Saran, Hypnoprogram, Dr. Jolly West, I mean, you got to go into all this. If you are uninitiated, I could see where you go, no, this is too much. But for people who have studied MK Ultra and mind control and psychic driving and are familiar with the Jolly West, right? These are crime scenes, and they should release all the photographs. And I was in shock when some people were writing, oh, this is private, Kennedy family matter. They shouldn't be released. Are you kidding me?
Well, that's naive. Those people are commenting in an emotional way, but to investigate the homicide, the assassination of the President of the United States, you're investigating the alteration of history, the intentional alteration of the course of history from, the war in Vietnam to the Civil Rights Act, Civil Rights movement in the South, and our whole relationship with other countries around the world. And it was altered then, and it continues to be altered today. But what happened in Dealey Plaza, it was a very conscious, intentional act by people high up in the government to create a different history than was the goal of the JFK and RFK.
Or some people might subscribe to higher than the government.
Well, whatever you call it,
Well, the church would call them the high cabal, right?
The
mover shakers of the world had a meeting like in one of, in the Nixon film, where they sit around and they go, that guy's got to go.
Yeah, well, I think Churchill was right most of the time. I think that at the present time, we have to be patient because the examination of 80,000 pages of new evidence, because it's new to us, and if we've seen it in the past, it was only in a redacted version, is going to take some time. On the other hand, the fact that all this evidence is coming out has changed my course, and I was writing a book about my experiences of dealing with the French intelligence, and I will somehow figure out a way to get that into my book, but I've decided to focus solely on the forensic evidence of the photographs and the ones that we thought we could rely on, but that have been altered. And I hope to get my book out sometime by November. And it will be something where people can hold the evidence in their hands in a book that's a little bit smaller than a coffee table book. And they can hold the evidence, and they can be persuaded by what they see and they don't need to talk to people about it or debate about it. It's not debatable. It's backed up by experts and engineers and people who are not involved in discussing the Kennedy assassination. They are, by day, professors and engineers and people that examine photographs for other reasons.
You know, I think it's a real education when you get into this case, just as an amateur historian, just a concerned citizen, that you wouldn't think that so many institutions would lie, would cover. And then when we find these USAID revelations, that how much money has gone on to promote, like they called it back there, the mighty Wurlitzer. You know, don't worry, I'll keep this from coming out, or we'll print it in a way that it doesn't, that leaves the, you know, the viewer unable to tell what really happened.
Yeah, well, there's only one way to print it to satisfy what our Constitution set up, and that is that the people deserve to know the truth. Whether they're of one political persuasion or another doesn't matter. What it happened to President Kennedy, which did change the course of our country's history, our economy, our everything about life in America, and in fact around the world. You know, when we see the evidence, we want to see the truth, and this will bring out the truth. And I applaud, you know, enthusiastic historians and researchers alike, and I hope that people will wake up and use this as a way of learning how power works. Because if power is unleashed and we don't have a constitution, then we don't have a country. And we need to really reexamine our love of the constitution, the rule of law, and this is a way to do it.
Well, thank goodness for the internet and people who are, you know, willing to, like for Black Op Radio or get at the truth like that.
Hey, thank goodness for Black Op Radio. I mean, you've done us a tremendous service with all the work that you've done. You're building up a library to rival Mary Farrell Foundation's library and archives. But by all the work that you've done interviewing people who pass on and those who don't, you know, by interviewing these people and putting their own words on tape or whatever you call it these days, digitally, and having an archives like you have, you know, your tenacity on this topic and the other topics of the other assassinations of the 60s is really something you need to, we should have a dinner for you.
Okay, well, I'll take you up on that next time I'm in L.A.
Good. Great, Len. Is there any other questions you wanted to ask me, or
well, I just,
shall we just
yeah,
do this
I did want to just ask you what you thought of the latest release of documents, because, you know, for whatever reason, you know, Trump, love him or hate him, he came through where Biden just obfuscated, and the first time I think Trump had his arm twisted where he said, I'm going to release these. And then the next day he says, no, I can't. We're going to, you know, the CIA's got to go through them more. I mean, it really underscores.
Well, he also had two administrations where, you know, Biden only had one. But in you know, I applaud Trump for finally coming through after first saying he was going to come through and then partially coming through and then being talked out of it. And then getting, you know, really the pressure from the community of people who have written books and who've taken the time out of their lives to study it on Trump did lead to this. And for that, if nothing else, we are grateful.
Yeah, I think Judge Andrew Napolitano was the one that kind of really bugged him. He said, you told us you were going to release these now. What are you going to do?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that you should remember, I'm involved in the making of a film about a very key individual who doesn't get much press, but he was a Secret Service agent appointed personally by John F. Kennedy to work in the White House detail. And he was the first African-American Secret Service agent ever to do that. And Kennedy said, would you like to be the first? and Abraham Bolden, who was guarding him in Chicago at McCormick Place, where he was making a speech after he was elected. Abraham Bolden said, "Yes, sir, I'd like that very much." I'm involved with Joshua Coates, who's a filmmaker, and making a movie about Abraham Bolden's life and his participation in this little corner of the assassination and his attempt to get the truth out about what he saw and what he observed. And I think that his book was called The Echo from Dealey Plaza. The movie will be called The Unseen Shield. And I'm very excited about that. But I promise you there is at least another website, another documentary, and another book that I'm writing. All of that's coming out this year. So if that's just my world, and imagine what you can do, and imagine who else is working on books like Chokehold, which I thought was a really excellent book by Jim DiEugenio, who appeared before the first meeting of the Congress on the JFK assassination, as well as Oliver Stone and Jeff. I think that there's a lot that's coming this year.
Well, very good. Well, I will get you to email me when you have some of these things ready, and I'd just be only too happy to help have you on and help.
Great. Thank you, Len. I appreciate the work you do.
All right, and I appreciate all the work you've done, too. So, once again, thank you for taking time tonight.
Thank you, and thank you to all your listeners.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we're speaking to Mr. Paul Blow from Quebec City. Bonjour.
Bonjour, Len. Comment ça va?
Ça va bien.
That's fun.
That's about it. So, I know that you have had a lot of news, and I saw that you were doing some interviews with the Chokeholds book, and I thought maybe you could give me an update and listeners about what's new with that and what has been going on with, obviously, everyone's talking about the documents release, and, you know, for people who are looking through them, they're finding some things, but to find anything is a little gem. And otherwise, there hasn't been a big explosion of here's the names of the guys who did it. But every time I see it, it's like it isn't the name Lee Oswald. It isn't, you know, it's like whatever the Warren Commission waved around is just turning out to the nth degree to be not true.
Definitely. Listen, I'll give you a little heads up about an article I'll be writing for Jim. Based on one of the files, it won't be a very long article, but it got my attention. And you know how I'm interested in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and everything. You know, I've always seen it, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, if you understand that Oswald was on a mission when he joined that organization, right? And that he, you know, setting the Fair Play for Cuba Committee up in New Orleans, where, I mean, you know, as if New Orleans had any appetite after the missile crisis. And, you know, Castro probably out there to disrupt trade with Latin America. There could have been a huge upheaval in their supply lines. And there just wasn't any chance you would have a successful Fair Play for Cuba Committee chapter in New Orleans in 1963. And yet Oswald starts one up, right? So that whole area there got me interested, because if you throw into that the fact that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, their numbers dwindled, the membership dwindled from 7,000 at its peak in 1961 to 1,500 by the time Oswald started his chapter, and it was really alive on paper only. The number of national meetings dwindled from 25 a year to 3 or fewer in 63. They were having financial difficulties. Their key sponsor was the Socialist, the SWP, the Socialist Workers Party. And they said, hey, you know what? By the middle of 1963, let's just keep it alive on paper. Really, there's not much use for it anymore. And that's when Oswald starts up his chapter. And he did it when it, those who were, the few, the remaining people who were part of it, a pretty good chunk of them were informants. And so when I started looking at all these prior plots, hey, Len, you know, with Von Marlow, who was a likely patsy in Los Angeles, and he was heading a Fair Play for Cuba chapter there. And you had Policarpo Lopez, who was a likely patsy in and around Tampa, and he attended Fair Play for Cuba committee meetings just before the assassination, and then escaped through Laredo and then Mexico City, and was reported to be the lone passenger on a plane to Cuba. And you know, so much of that, I mean, Harry Dean, Fair Play for Cuba committee, and Richard K. Snegel, who got himself, you know, thrown in jail before the assassination went down, so he wouldn't take any part of the blame. And he had Fair Play for Cuba committee flyers in his vehicle. And, you know, the Fair Play for Cuba committee was also noted in his notebook. So, and there are so many others. You know, I was on your show explaining the Pepe letters, how in 1962, someone called Pepe Menendez was sending letters that was suggesting that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK in 62 in November that was being orchestrated by Cuban agents in Cuba and in the U.S. And this Menendez guy, who was credited or blamed for sending the letters, which he likely didn't, had been the head of the Fair Play for Cuba committee in Tampa. Anyway, I found a nice document in the release recently released file, and it's a memorandum, and it's called, the subject is called Requirements Briefing to FBI Informant Going to Cuba. Okay, it's a briefing document, and the person they're briefing, Len, is a guy called Thomas Vicente. Now, I don't know if that name rings a bell, but he's the guy who sent Oswald all his Fair Play for Cuba committee literature, and he was an informant. Okay, he was an FBI informant, and he was born in Puerto Rico. He had been under FBI control for nearly 3 years. And they put him into the Fair Play for Cuba committee. They had put him in, you know, they were planning to put him in the Communist Party. He was in three organizations spying on those organizations from within. Now, what's interesting is his briefing was to go to Cuba in the middle of early 1963, right? And in other words, it says the subject is leaving New York City for Mexico City on July 13th. And, you know, he expects to go to Cuba illegally on July 15th. Okay? And what he was going to do is he was going to use Fair Play for Cuba committee credentials, okay, and a letter of introduction from V.T. Lee, Vincent Theodore Lee. And, you know, and that the Fair Play for Cuba committee raised $100 for his trip. Now, that is so like the way, now, you'll notice that they're organizing it for an informant called Vicente. Now, that's the exact same pattern that was used to get Oswald through to Cuba, supposedly, because, you know, we know he was impersonated in Mexico City. But nevertheless, the idea was to use Oswald, or the claim that he would use his Fair Play for Cuba committee credentials to go to Mexico City and to use literature, Fair Play for Cuba Committee literature, to be able to, you know, get his papers to be able to go to Cuba. And it didn't work. Now, the thing is, in the past, it did work. So what Oswald tried to do is what the CIA was setting up Vicente to do in July. Exactly. So you have to ask yourself, this travel logistics that Vicente was using and that was being organized by the CIA, it certainly looks like it's the same darn thing that's being done with Oswald, right? Now, the other thing they point out in this document is that Vincent T. Lee, who headed the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, okay, he had been head of the Tampa chapter, and when the higher-ups in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the founders, Gibson, and I think it's Tabor, left. They abandoned the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. He's the guy who took over. Well, they say in this memorandum that this was the same method that V.T. Lee used when he visited Cuba. Now, what that tells me is that Vincent T. Lee, I have an article about him, and I pretty well concluded from the article that he was an informant also. So when you see that the Fair, and now he's a guy who corresponded with Oswald a number of times and told Oswald, don't open a chapter up in New Orleans and so on and so forth. But these travel logistics mirror one another. So how can two informants be using exactly the same travel pattern as supposedly a lone nut who's doing all this on his own, right? And it kind of reminds me of when Oswald went to Russia and he took that route through Finland, and he would have known all that it was an easier entry point to get into Russia through Finland, and he stayed in two five-star or very luxurious hotels that he couldn't afford. So this is what I'm writing about, and there's more stuff in this memorandum. It's really interesting, and I think what it's going to show is that the people that are organizing the trip for Vicente include people like Anita Pataki. Now, who's Anita Pataki? She works directly for William Harvey, right? And you have another guy called Henry Kitchens. He's also, you know, part of the Harvey, the Harvey network, if I could put it that way. Anita Pataki helped Santiago Garriga, set up a Miami chapter. So you have Anita Pataki seems to be this person that helps coordinate all these things around AmSanta, which was a program by the CIA to disrupt the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, or to use it. And that was headed by who? People like David Attlee Phillips, James McCord, okay? And so this is a really interesting document that, points to the cooperation between the FBI and the CIA. The other thing that stands out in here, right, is they're talking to the FBI to use assets that, were people related either to the Communist Party or the Fair Play for Cuba Committee that they were running for penetration missions to Cuba. So what would that be? One of the guys they were dealing with was a guy called Mr. Schwant. He was the FBI liaison guy. So I think when I'll write that article up, I still have to decode a few things in there, but it's really interesting. And it shows that, obviously, when the informants are working for intelligence on U.S. soil, they would tend to be linked more with the FBI. That's why Oswald, when he was in New Orleans, and he's arrested for a little bit of a scuffle, right? Probably a fake scuffle with Carlos Bringier. He's in jail, and he asks to meet who? He asks to meet Warren DeBries of the FBI, who couldn't make it, so he sends a guy called Quigley, and he spends between an hour and a half and 3 hours with this FBI guy for a minor street scuffle. Does that make any sense? What does that tell you? It tells you, right, that really it's a guy who's meeting his controller. So that's what we're seeing here. You know, it's something I think that's really interesting that I won't spend too much time on it, and I'll give you a better description of the whole thing, you know, when I finish the article, but really interesting. So I know Jim last week talked about a lot of interesting files. This is an interesting file. And I found some other ones. I found some other interesting files that I'll tell you about.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm looking forward to that stuff coming out. And people can keep up to date with you at the Chokehold's website and also your writing for Kennedy's and King.
Yeah. Right. So the other big news, Len, with regard to chokeholds, is this is fun because I told you I'd talk to you about it, is in about 2 weeks, the French version of the JFK assassination chokeholds will be ready. And look, there's not as big a population of French people, you know, as there are, Anglophones around the world, but there are not that many books that have been translated into French. I know Jim Douglas's book was JFK and the Unspeakable, but other than that, I don't know of many. I'll tell you, very few books. And the reason there's already interest for it is, you know, when you and Oliver Stone and Jim DiEugenio came to Quebec City, you remember all the media interest that garnered?
Yeah, it was significant, you know.
It was very significant. And what happened is when the Luna Committee or the Luna Task Force, talked about the declassification and that the declassification would take place in mid-March, the French media in Quebec took notice. And they said, hey, who's that guy? You know, who's that JFK guy that's from Quebec? You know, so just by Googling and whatnot, my name started popping up again, and I didn't solicit any calls, but major media was calling me. CBC French called me. The biggest dailies in the province of Quebec called me and interviewed me. And they wanted to know my opinion about the files. So I did a few podcasts. I did some about three or four radio interviews, two dailies, and the whole Quebec Or is sort of, I don't know, the French-Canadian Rogers equivalent, if you want. Huge, hugely influential media empire in Quebec. They covered it. And every time I talk to them, they say, well, what are you up to? I said, well, we're going to have our book put in French. Every single one of them wants me back on to discuss it. So that's what we're talking about here, Len, is mainstream media. So, you know, we had an awful lot of really fun exposure for chokeholds, but proportionately, it was mostly, you know, specialized media. There wasn't that much mainstream media for chokeholds. In Quebec, there's interest there. They want to know. They want to read the version, and they said, let us know when it will be in French. And so I think that's important because, you know, sometimes the truth doesn't necessarily have to come directly from within American mainstream media. If you get enough foreign media, and you know that there's
opinion. Well, you could give the example of Mark Lane. He couldn't get his book published in America, but a publishing company in England did
it. That's right. That's right. And then you had the men who killed Kennedy, and then you had the BBC documentaries, and even Canada, the Fifth Estate had something once where they had Jefferson Morley on. So you get an awful lot of... So I think that this is hugely important because it will have, I think, repercussions in the English world if it's successful in the French world.
Yeah.
And look, we know that foreign media is way more receptive to, conspiracies. I mean, they lived with conspiracies with, British intelligence, French intelligence. They knew that they had assassination teams and that's where the CIA learned their tricks of the trade. They went and interviewed, MI6 and the French intelligence, and they say, well, how do you carry out an assassination? So they learned their tricks of the trade by working closely with European intelligence agencies. And when you go to, I was in France, the assumption there is that there's a conspiracy. It's not, they don't put in, if you talk to them about the Warren Commission, they don't even know what that is and they don't care, right? They just know, hey, look, he's taken out from a high-powered building, and the guy who took him out is assassinated 2 days later. End of story. There's a conspiracy. they don't make it complicated. And when you think of it, that's one of the most suspicious things there is that how could Oswald be taken out 48 hours later? So anyway, that's why I say I think I have a really receptive... So it's not as large a market, but it's certainly a passionate market. And I'm looking forward to doing that because, I have my eyes in Quebec. What will be a bit more of a challenge will be Belgium, France, the French parts of Switzerland. You know that even London, England, has a huge French population?
Bonne chance.
Well, merci beaucoup, and I'll be back online to discuss other stuff.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, thanks for just taking time tonight just to give me a short update and listeners. And, let's go keep going through. Just the other day, somebody again wanted a copy of the Garrison Files.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, so I got that off to him. And so once again, thanks to you really going through them and making them public and just talking about them and us publicizing. Have you seen what's in there? Go through them. And all people have to do is ask, and I email it to them.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful, because there is stuff in there. It's worth reading.
Yeah. I haven't even gotten through all of it. It's like filing cabinets worth of stuff down to PDFs, right? And you look at one file and it's 46 pages long. And this is not light reading. This is like every paragraph I kind of stop and reread it. Okay, I've got that. Okay, here's another name. What? Oh, I know this guy. What? Oh, it's like that.
The master index at Paul Abbott, I did not have that tool. In a way, I couldn't have it. It took him a year to make it, that tool. But the thing is that when you read the Garrison Files, you're talking about over 10,000 pages, right? And they're pretty dense. And then what happens when you read them is you see patterns appear. It could be every 500th page, you'll say something, wait a minute, I read something. This can't be a coincidence, right? So you read it and you say, where do I have to go back to find that information? Because, you're seeing almost corroboration of something you read earlier. So it's a difficult thing to do. So the more people that read it, those documents are what told me that Oswald had Latino escorts for years. I mean, I'm talking about over 2 years. I shouldn't say years. He had him for when he came back from Russia, but these escorts existed before Oswald came back because they were seen in from Russia because they were seen in Bannister's office and in the company of Bannister and sometimes Ferry. And their descriptions are too unique for them not to be referring to at least one of the Latinos as the same person. So anyway.
Okay. Well, once again, thanks for taking time out tonight.
No problem.
I had a busy schedule, and we'll keep in touch. And then as your articles are approaching publishing date, always just give me an email, and I'll be just more than too glad to help publicize your good work and help promote it.
Thank you, Len. Have a nice evening.
All right. You too. Au revoir.
Au revoir.